I think we should begin. These are 7-minute presentations, and there will be 7 minutes of works in progress. We go in alphabetical order. We begin with Tom Bell from Chapman, who will be talking about libertarian but not originalist constitutionalism.
Thank you, Eugene. Thank you all. I'd like to very briefly describe to you an approach to constitutional meaning, which is libertarian but not originalist. Perhaps we could begin by, with all due respect to Justice Marshall, forgetting for a moment that it's a constitution we're expounding. I'd like to suggest instead we regard the Constitution as something more akin to a contract or perhaps a covenant running with the land. Why would we do that? We would do that for the same reason that common law courts routinely grapple with the problems of finding the meaning of contracts or covenants running with the land, because they want to defend the consent of those allegedly bound by those sorts of documents or institutions. If we take that approach to the Constitution, we start with the ideal found, for example, in a bargain for exchange of express consent to terms between equals. That's sort of the ideal that we would hope to find in constitutional law. Of course, we don't. When you look at the Constitution, we find, naturally enough, it falls very far short of an express contract. Now, that's not a fatal failing in my view. There are libertarians, those of an anarcho-capitalist bent, such as Lysander Spooner, who regard the Constitution, therefore, as per se illegal and unjustified. I have a more graduated approach to the problem, which I'll describe. But I think we should recognize there's a problem looking at the Constitution if we care about consent. Well, if we apply to the Constitution, as I've suggested and we'll talk about, the rules that we've derived from many, many centuries cases of interpreting contracts, we end up deciding to protect consent, you should look for the plain, present, public meaning of the Constitution's terms. I won't spend much time defending the search for plain and public meanings. It's, with regard to my originalist friends, that second qualification, present meaning, that we'll have to focus on. Before we get there, though, let me describe to you sort of graphically, since I have so little time and pictures are worth 1,000 words, the sort of approach to constitutional meaning that I have in mind. This is, of course, the Nolan chart, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, so I won't dwell on it. I just want you to look at it so you'll understand how it maps on to the sort of scheme that I see when I look at current debates over constitutional meaning. On the left, we have the living constitutionalists, those who care about the responsiveness of the Constitution to current needs and current subjects. That's a virtue. I think that's a good thing. There are problems, of course, with that approach to the Constitution, just as there are problems with the left-wing approach to a variety of rights. The left-wingers care about social liberties. They derogate economic ones. That, of course, libertarians say is a problem. They like to transcend the traditional left-right debates. On the right-hand side, continuing this analogy, we have originalists who pursue the virtue of textual fidelity. That is indeed a virtue. I think it's one we should defend and support. But it's not enough. That's why I propose a consensualist, which comes from the word consent, a consensualist approach, which is a libertarian, I will not defend it as the only, but a libertarian approach to constitutional meaning. In this approach to constitutional meaning, what we look for is a meaning that is responsive to current understandings among those governed by the Constitution and also faithful to the text of the Constitution. That's why we look for the plain, present public meaning. Why do we care so much about consent? Maybe you don't. I do. I think it's pretty easy to defend consent as at least a prima facie good. I've written about this. I have a paper coming out in which I've developed a theory of justification of political and other institutions which is premised on consent. I can here only offer you a caricature of what takes up many pages in that article, but again, hopefully a picture is worth at least 1,000 words. Looking at this over on the left-hand side, you can see that it's quite easy to break out consent into this binary relation, consent and unconsent. And it's not surprising to argue that people are more bound when they consent to things than when they object to them. Simple enough. I like to think I've added something to our understanding of how consent works in the law and in political justification, however, and that in my many years of teaching common law courses, contract law, tort law, and now this year property law, I think I found enough cases to argue there is, in fact, a spectrum of consent. We can break out just focusing on consent, because unconsent is merely a mirror image of what we find in consent, just focusing on consent, we see their gradations of consent. Now, if you can take your mind back to your first year courses, cases like Cottenham, for example. Doctors come across a man unconscious in the street and they render aid. They later demand payment. Are they justified in so doing? Yes, they are. Because, hypothetically, you would want to have aid rendered under those circumstances. However, if this patient had woken up and said, "Go away, I want to lie here and bleed," I don't think any of us would hesitate to say that express unconsent would trump the hypothetical consent. Just one little example of a pattern you can find throughout the law. Please do look at my paper if you want to get the details. But in this, I find a theory of justification, which we can apply not only to questions that common law courts have grappled with, but also constitutional law. I'm going to show you some of the things that you get out of this very quickly. If you've taught contract law or you remember contract law, none of this will surprise you. What courts look for when they interpret contracts with an eye to preserving the consent of the parties, is they look for the plain present public meaning. There's a non-waivable obligation of good faith and fair dealing. The objective meaning, not subjective intent, controls. Plain meaning trumps course of performance. In this analogy with constitutional law, that means notwithstanding precedents to the contrary, we always recur to the text of the Constitution. If the text of the Constitution tells us we need to have a public use before there's a taking a private party, well, darn it, that means public. It doesn't mean a private party. Most interestingly, perhaps, in cases of vagueness, we favor individual liberty. This is a direct analog to constitutional, to Randy Barnett's presumption of liberty. This last bit here, I'll simply say, it's a bit problematic, if you care about consent, that federal courts alone are entrusted with deciding the interpretation of constitutional terms. Instead, I suggest, and this is developed in my paper, we should use independent arbitrating bodies. You get some interesting substantive results from this approach. I'll just flip these out here and let you look at them. Scalia recently debated Breyer, and he argued that, in fact, public floggings are constitutional because they were at the time of the founding. I think that would be a shock to many people today. And I think that's a problem for originalists. I don't have that problem, but still. I could say more if I had more time. I won't. So I'll just wrap it up here. This is a consensualist approach. It's an alternative to originalism. In it, we look for the plain, present, public meaning. On most counts, I'll say, we get the same results as originalism. We really do. I don't have a lot of arguments with my originalist friends. But it takes, as Eugene has written, a theory to beat a theory. And my originalist friends do not seem to have a theory of justification. If they do, I'd be happy to talk with them about that. But although we don't disagree much about the results, we do disagree about the approach to these problems. What we should look for, I argue, is both responsiveness to those now living under the Constitution and fidelity to the text of the Constitution. What we end up with is a way to maximize the consent of those governed by the Constitution. That's what makes, if it does, the Constitution justified with respect to those of us living under it. This is a libertarian result, not necessarily an originalist one, but I hope my friends in the originalist camp will see that it's really not too much of a challenge. We get many of the same answers, but it's a slightly different approach to constitutional meaning. Thank you.
Thank you.
We turn to Robin Efron from Brooklyn Law School. She'll be talking about commonalities of fact and law.
So I'll be talking to you about the rules of joinder today in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Those of you who can think back to that first year course might remember that there are two phrases that occur in several places in the rules of joinder. One is same transaction or occurrence. The other one is common question of law or fact. These two phrases are the ones that are used as the baseline for whether a claim or a party has enough in common with the anchor claim in order to justify joinder. What I argue is that using these two phrases and using this commonalities approach to joinder has created a host of problems, and we should rethink how we approach joinder in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, many people have observed that there are a vast range of interpretations of just what is the same transaction or occurrence, or how do we know what is a common question of law or fact. Now, many of these different and conflicting interpretations are pushed aside, and people say, well, we don't need a common meaning because joinder is meant to be a highly discretionary case management doctrine, so it's not a problem that we have these multiple and conflicting meanings. It's simply a factor of having discretionary case management rules. I think we can do better. What I do in my paper is I explore what I call the shadow rules of joinder, which courts have developed, and then I suggest how these might help us reframe the rules. So what are these shadow rules of joinder? The shadow rules of joinder are doctrines that judges have created around these two phrases to manipulate their meaning. And I've identified three rules. One is a rule that I call heightened commonality. I borrow that from heightened pleading, which many of you might know from the pre-Twombly and Iqbal context. And what this means is that courts will take that phrase, either same transaction or occurrence, or common question of law or fact, and say, I recognize that this claim and this claim do arise out of the same transaction or occurrence. However, in this instance, it's not same enough. We need something more. And they, in fact, require a commonality beyond simply the same transaction or occurrence, right, which is different from what that requires. We see that in several rules. It happens with compulsory counterclaims in 13A. It happens with relation back under 15C, and occurs in several places. The second shadow rule of joinder that I've identified is something that I call implied predomination. Now, implied predomination is a situation in which courts once again recognize that there is, in fact, a common question of law or fact, or that there is, in fact, the same transaction or occurrence. But what they do is look at everything that is common and everything that is not common about the cases, about the claims or the parties. They then conclude that individual issues predominate over the common issues. Now, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this is that it's not actually what those phrases mean and require. In fact, it comes to us from a different rule, from Rule 23b2, which is a class action rule, which does require that predomination. So what I've noticed is that courts are importing this standard of implied predomination into the general standard of when there is the same transaction or occurrence, or when there is the common question of law or fact. And the final shadow rule that I've developed is quite a complicated one. It's where much of my analysis resides. And that is a situation in which courts will manipulate the categories of fact and law in order to conclude that something is or is not part of the same transaction or occurrence, or part of a common question of law or fact. Now, the first error is very, very easy to identify, actually. It's a textual error. The rule says common question of law or fact. You would be shocked by the number of judges who change that or to an and. They require both a common issue of fact and law, conclude that one or the other doesn't exist, and move on. But a more sly version of that occurs when courts imply that you need both fact and law. Then they re-describe factual questions as legal questions, or they re-describe legal questions as factual questions in order to conclude that these issues fall outside of the boundaries of the same transaction or occurrence. Now, what's wrong with this situation? Many people might look at it and say, well, if the doctrines are meant to be highly discretionary, and judges ultimately come to what we might say is the right conclusion about whether to join claims or parties, why does it matter that they're sort of messing around with the same transaction or occurrence or the common question of law or fact standard? My first problem is simply a matter of rule interpretation, that it's problematic to have the same words within a closed set of rules that mean different things both within each rule and across the rules as a matter of interpretation. But I think that more broadly, what we learn is that when you look at the shadow rules are often in conflict with one another. That when judges take a case management approach, they cherry pick from among these three rules, whether it be heightened commonality, whether it be implied predomination, or whether it be manipulating these questions of law and fact in order to come to the case management result. I think that we would have a better system of joinder if there were clearer standards for what judges were doing, right? If it's a matter of case management, then those case management rules should be addressed to the specific needs of each rule of joinder instead of pretending that what we're looking for is commonalities. If we're in fact looking for better case management, efforts should be directed at case management, not towards this mythical ideal of what claims do or do not have in common, or whether parties have enough in common with one or another. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We turn now to Professor Efron's colleague, Professor Minor Myers, who's going to be speaking also from Brooklyn, will be speaking on the perverse effect of shareholder voting on executive compensation.
So last year's Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation included a controversial corporate reform that requires that every public company hold a periodic non-binding shareholder vote on its executive compensation. Essentially, every year shareholders will vote the company's disclosed compensation up or down, but the results won't be binding on anyone. In a nutshell, my argument is that supporters and detractors of this reform, and the reform's known as Say on Pay, have overlooked the potential for it to have an unintended consequence on executive pay. Under some very plausible conditions, shareholder approval can partially insulate directors from criticism for bad compensation decisions, and this perversely can lead to more director discretion, which may result in pay packages that are higher and less sensitive to performance than they are now, the opposite goal of those who promoted Say on Pay. Let me step back and set this up a little bit. So CEO compensation is the product of negotiation between, on the one hand, a board compensation committee, and on the other, the CEO. In the view of many observers, this system for setting executive compensation is fundamentally broken, because even nominally independent directors can't be trusted to negotiate with the CEO at arm's length. The most well-known articulation of this view comes from Lucian Bebchuk and Jesse Fried. And the foundation of their model is that CEOs have a great deal of power over members of the board, including those on the compensation committee, and that CEOs use this power to ensure that their compensation is as high as possible and, most importantly, as insensitive to performance as possible. For Bebchuk and Fried, the operative constraint on what CEOs can extract isn't market forces, but instead is what they call outrage. And by outrage, they mean negative reactions by people outside the firm whose views directors care about. Institutional investors, the business media, directors' social and professional groups. This, for Bebchuk and Fried, is the real constraint on what board members will allow CEOs to extract in compensation. And this is where the say-on-pay reform comes in. The intuition's relatively straightforward. Shareholders want the company to use compensation to reward success and to punish failure. And with the advisory vote, shareholders will have the opportunity to vote against pay arrangements that are inadequately sensitive to performance. No votes, the idea is, will attract a great deal of negative attention in the media and in directors' social circles. One compensation consultant, for example, likened a no vote under the shareholder advisory voting regime to a vote of no confidence in the board of directors. In other words, what's really supposed to happen is the no vote is supposed to animate precisely these forces of outrage that Bebchuk and Fried say constrains executive pay in the first place. So to avoid a no vote, the idea is that directors will negotiate or modify compensation in a way to placate shareholders. In this way, the board's desire to reward the CEO is going to be checked by the shareholders' self-interest. So Say on Pay has plenty of detractors, and in the same breath, many of these detractors critique not just Say on Pay, but the Bebchuk and Fried model that it grows out of. I'm assuming that all the objections to Say on Pay are met, and I'm assuming the correctness of the Bebchuk and Fried model, not necessarily because I believe it's right, but because I want to evaluate Say on Pay from within the model that gave birth to it. So supporters of SANPAY focus on the strategic consequences that the threat of the no vote poses to boards and how that can push pay and performance into greater alignment. But I think they've overlooked the countervailing strategic consequences of a yes vote. So currently, when outrage is directed at a company's executive compensation, directors bear the entirety of the outrage. This focus penalty is what makes outrage such a tight constraint on pay in Bebchuk and Fried's model. But all that changes in a world of mandatory shareholder advisory voting. Once shareholders have ratified compensation at a firm, future outrage will be directed not exclusively at directors, but at shareholders and directors together. Shareholders will have approved the compensation that's later judged to be by some outsider to be outrageous. So in this way, shareholder approval of executive compensation can provide boards with a measure of insurance against the risk that their reputations will be damaged in the future by outrage. So there's more to this. Like any insurance scheme, this one comes with a form of moral hazard. If directors are partially insured against outrage over compensation, they have less incentive to avoid provoking that outrage in the first place. Say and pay may thus weaken, from within the Bebchuk and Fried model, say and pay may thus weaken the operative constraint on boards' ability to lavish performance insensitive pay on CEOs. So boards may be more willing to offer types and levels of compensation that they would have been hesitant to offer before. Of course, this insurance effect comes only if shareholders approve the compensation. And to approve the compensation, to get compensation approved, boards may have to modify the compensation in ways shareholders find beneficial. But it's these two consequences of SANPAY, the insurance effect and the modification effect, that are really two sides of the same coin. One only comes at the expense of the other, and I think supporters of the bill have focused too much on just the one. The critical question is figuring out which of these effects is going to predominate. And I think there's a limit to what shareholders will be able to achieve in terms of modifications to executive compensation. And I'm short on time, so I won't go into those. But I think the net effect of say on pay is ultimately unclear. At bad firms, or firms with bad compensation, there may be some net benefits for shareholders. But at firms with already good compensation, there may be net costs. This insurance effect may outweigh the modification effect. And I think that may explain part of why you saw a number of companies sort of rushing to put this in place long before Congress ever mandated it a few years ago. Aflac is an example. So on balance, I think it's not clear that shareholder advisory voting is going to do much to bring pay and performance into greater alignment. It may, in fact, aggravate the disjunction between pay and performance. Thanks.
Our next speaker is Professor William Wagner from Thomas M. Cooley Law School on the jurisprudential battle over the character of a nation, understanding the emerging threats to unalienable liberty in America.
I make my titles longer and longer these days, I think. But the work in progress is just that. It's the jurisprudential battle over the character of a nation. And what it is my kind of small contribution to a book coming out by LexisNexis called The Jurisprudence of Liberty. Now, I got to warn you, if you buy the book, most of the authors swim in much deeper jurisprudential waters than I do. Most of them are legal, if not all other than myself, are probably legal, would describe themselves as legal positivists. And what motivated me to write the piece was that one of the editors called from Australia and asked and said, would I talk about the change in the way that Americans perceive liberty? And the question kind of took me aback for a moment, and I had worked with religious liberty groups and represented persecuted Christians and in different parts of the world, and had seen the effect of those that take a worldview that is more based in legal positivism. And so I kind of understood what he was asking for, but I really hadn't thought about the shift that he was looking for, more like a shift in a paradigm. And so I started rereading constitutional law cases that I had been teaching for years, and started, you know, doing like we used to do before we had computers, and going back and hand shepherdizing, looking at different parts of opinions that were being cited in areas of liberty, not necessarily moving, for example, from an area with regard to establishment clause and creation and origins of the universe, and then looking at cases involving defining what life was and whether it was important enough an interest that deserved protection of the state and what stages it did, and then seeing the abortion cases and the partial birth abortion cases and looking at the different parts of those opinions that were extracted and then used as part of good legal strategy to move other areas of the law in other areas of liberty. And all of a sudden, it kind of hit me. I know why this guy wants me to write this. There's been a shift in the paradigm. What explains the shift, though? You know, our founders, wrote, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And for the first time in a long time, I asked, well, why are they self-evident? And you can, and again, with those of you that swim in deeper jurisprudential waters than I do, there are, you go into all the natural law theory and transcendental natural law theory versus other natural law theory and can come up with some good explanations for why our founders had a concept of liberty that is very different than many of the folks that govern the nation now and many of the folks that sit on our United States courts and our state courts. And so what this piece does is attempts to analyze that. And I know we've got volumes written on different interpretive approaches, and it sounds like a new challenge here from my new friend, Professor Bell. The question that I now ask, though, whether I'm looking at something that's talking about originalism or some organic or some process-based theory, is I ask, well, who is writing it and what's their worldview? And that's what my contribution attempts to look at. It's something called worldview. Now, in the English language, we don't have a word for the word worldview. That's not a real word. If you put it in, it'll have a little red line underneath it in your computer telling you that you're misspelling it because it doesn't exist. The Germans have a word for it. I can't pronounce it. It's Weltanschauung or something to that effect. But it is a framework that how we see, and I would suggest, for our purposes, a jurisprudential framework. How do we see the world? How do we interpret all of the world? Do we, as our founders, for the most part, believe that God really exists? And if God really exists and our liberty truly does come from a creator, do we look at liberty and on the bench decide that something is a fundamental right or is a fundamental liberty? Do we reach that conclusion in a different way than someone that says God doesn't exist? And that our liberty doesn't come from that, and liberty is something that is a human notion that is completely devoid of any moral or ethical element, and that's the way it should be. So I look at worldview, and I attempt, I think, for the first time, at least in my writing, to suggest that maybe we ought to be not just considering the interpretive approach that a justice or a judge or somebody else that has power is using, but to ask a question that maybe precedes the interpretive approach. What is their worldview? Why are they choosing an organic approach? Why are they choosing an originalist approach? And I think once you do that, the cases, at least involving liberty, and especially involving notions of what I would call an alienable liberty, liberty that is self-evident, the idea that life and human life has positive value that the government should protect. The idea that a parent, a man and a woman that marries and procreates a child, that those two parents have the fundamental right to control and direct the upbringing of the child, including the educational choices and medical choices for the child and maintaining the custody of the child. The idea of the free exercise of one's religious conscience. Some of those fundamental liberties can be understood if you look at the assumption that underlies the interpretive approach it's using. And likewise, the shift can be understood as well. Because if your idea is to remove God from the picture, if your idea is to remove any moral or ethical element from the law or liberty, well, you've got to come up with an interpretive approach that allows you to do that. And so it's back in the back. Feel free to grab it on the way out. I got to warn you that the approaches they use over in Australia, which is, I think, where this is based out of, I sent them with all these citations, and two things happened. Number one, it created a war between the two editors, one who was a believer in God and one who didn't. One thought that this thing ought to be published without a single comma change. That's never happened to me in my entire life. The only thing he wanted to change was how we spell it so that we spell it in the Australian English way. The other guy said, absolutely, this should not be published and isn't worthy of anybody reading it. So after they worked that out, then the question was, well, how do we cite? And they took out, for some reason, they don't cite like we over here do. We cite every fact and every law, and so we're still in negotiations. I'm trying to encourage them to include more case citations and stuff. So if you're wondering why we're missing some of the cites, it's due to some editorial things going on. But anyways, I'd be happy to hear any.
Thank you very much to everyone on the panel for adhering to our rigid rules, rigid time rules, excuse me, which leaves us time for some questions. Here's what I would like to do, if possible. I'll happily take whatever question there is, but then if we could have questions for the other panel members and just make sure that if at all possible there's a question, at least one question for each panel member, I think that would be good, because I take it one of the purposes of this is to help the panel members with their projects. So let's turn to John first.
Back to Chapman, but I do want to press a little bit. Initially, I was unclear how your evolving consent model differed from Bruce Ackerman's constitutional moments. And then you brought it back to, but it has to be rooted in the text. And so, my question is, well, how is that different than textual originalism? You know, so where between those two do you fall down? And then the second question is, how do you deal with the problem articulated in the Declaration of Independence, the difference between suffering abuses of constitutional illegitimate action while they remain sufferable, versus interpreting that same non-action as consent?
I'll have to answer more briefly than your excellent questions really require, John, so my colleagues can have a shot at questions too. With regard to the first, what matters, the difference is sort of the data set you're looking at. To determine meaning, we want to look at linguistic usage within a particular community. Ackerman cares about ratification post the late 1700s for good reasons. Originalists focused more on an earlier period, but I would argue really we need to look at the present because it's right now living people that we're confronting with armed force when we enforce the Constitution against them. It's their consent that matters. Now, originalists will and should, and I thank them for noting, that I'm worried courts are going to get it wrong. How can we trust courts to get right now the present meaning of the text? And I have some answers to that. I'll say that is a salient problem. I also, John, don't trust courts to get it right, so I do have answers to that. But short answer, we look at the present meaning, not even if we're interpreting, say, the 14th Amendment. We don't look at the post-Civil War era. But I'll stop there with that one. Your second question, I'm not sure I understood it, but I would say, if I understand your question, to paraphrase, you're wondering how do we take consent to be expressed when people are suffering under a rule that they're not happy with? Well, that's why I've offered a spectrum of consent. There can certainly be factual questions about exactly how much unconsent people are feeling and expressing, but basically you have a sliding scale. It's not enough to say, certainly, that simply because people put up with some sort of rule, they thereby consent to it. At most, you have some measure of implied consent. But if people at the same time say, look, I'm living here in this country, but I object to this particular form of allegedly constitutional rule, the express unconsent would trump that supposed implied consent. But I'll stop there. We can talk about this more later, John, but I want to let you guys have a crack at my colleagues here.
Yes.
Question for William. Actually, comment. John Finnis had an article in the American Journal of Jurisprudence a year or two ago on Isha A. Hart and the internal point of view, which, of course, at the time, was revolutionary in its sense, contrary to realists and everything. If I read it correctly, he took things to say that Hart didn't take the internal point of view seriously enough, and that if he had, it might actually lead to what John Finnis later produced in Natural and Natural Rights. I say that because it sounds to me like your work, you might actually be amenable to John
Francis in
your
word,
worldview, and so that might be all.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Other, yes, in the back.
I don't see who it is.
Oh, Lee. Lee. You were occluded by a head.
Yes, I understand. This is a problem I have in life sometimes. I have a question for Minor, which is, how would we sort out which of these two effects is happening, and do you have a plan on that?
I don't have, can you hear me? I don't have a plan on it. I think it's very hard to sort it. It'll be very hard to sort out what's happening, because there's not only debate about what say-on-pay will produce, but there's underlying debate about what motivations directors actually have. So if pay improves, you could say, well, and I don't know how to test for this, but you could say, well, that's because say-on-pay has accomplished something good. Directors are still bad, but say-on-pay is keeping them in check. Or you could say that, well, I'm right, and directors have more discretion now that there's say-on-pay, more discretion to sort of ignore what's happening on the outside. They naturally want to do things that are good for shareholders for other reasons. And so I think you could, either interpretation is available for however things move, and I don't yet have the sort of empirical design to test it out. But
yes, Mark.
For Robin, I'm sorry I came in a little. I'm sorry I came in a little late, so you might have addressed this. But I almost heard you suggesting that commonalities of law and fact had a very plain meaning, and that when judges stray from that plain meaning, and I guess I think commonalities is itself a term that has a rather broad spread. I suppose you'd say it's a vague term. How do you identify on that spectrum where there's enough commonality to say that it's that there is a commonality? Or do you have a mechanism for that that gives clearer content than you're suggesting courts are giving now?
So I actually agree with you. I think that it is not a term with plain meaning. I cleverly did not use my 7 minutes to give my suggestion for what should happen. I think the fact that there is this wide spectrum and that it's very context specific means that the commonalities approach actually is not a good one for simple joinder. I leave complex litigation out of my analysis. So what I end up suggesting in the paper is that we actually abandon the attempt to say that we know how common is common enough. In other words, that there is a meaning either for common question of law or fact or transaction or occurrence. What I suggest in the paper is replacing it with going all the way out to the edge of Article 3 for what could be enjoinder, sort of the way 1367 works a little bit, and instead that each rule focus on the more management managerial or practicalities approach. So, for example, in compulsory counterclaims, instead of saying, here's what's common enough for a counterclaim, you give a standard for why the second case should be precluded. On the other hand, in 15C, which is the rule about relation back of added claims to initial complaint, which has very, very different concerns and practicality concerns, again, instead of trying to say, here's what's common enough, that you give more management-oriented guidance to judges. Still going to be hard to find a plain meaning, still going to be kind of a case-by-case approach, but at least we sort of move away from this idea that there is a single meaning of commonality that would apply across the board.
Okay, we have gone around, and now it's time for Ilya.
Earlier presumption, but I couldn't resist asking Tom questions because I actually written about the same issue in my first, and probably we cited WAD Journal article revitalizing consent, which I think you may have seen. But regardless, I have a sort of two interrelated questions. One is, I get from your account how your theory of the present public meaning means that for current contemporary people who are alive, it's easier to understand what the meaning is. But I'm not sure that necessarily means it's more consensual or even consensual at all. For instance, I understand very well that the text of the Constitution gives Congress the power to impose protectionist measures against foreign goods, but I certainly have never consented it. I don't agree that it's a legitimate power of government, even though it's clear in the textual meaning of the Constitution. Secondly, and closely related, I wonder how your project stands in relationship to numerous theories that give non-consensual justifications for government power. So maybe we haven't consented to certain government powers, but maybe they're necessary for other reasons, such as to increase utility, promote equality, what have you. Is it your view that the exclusive basis for the legitimacy of government power of a constitution is consent, or are there other bases which will also play a role in your theory? Thank you.
Wow. Okay, I'll try to be quick. By the way, I remembered that I misattributed to Eugene one of the ideas I got from him. It wasn't that it takes a theory to beat a theory. That's Richard Epstein, another libertarian giant. From Eugene, I got the notion that you have to give something up with your constitutional theory, but I won't talk about that. So let me take your second question first. Basically, I regard arguments that disregard consent as fundamentally still within the framework I've offered. They're premised typically, in my view, on hypothetical consent. They'll say things like, you know, well, we shouldn't care so much about what these people think because this is good for them anyhow. Well, that's hypothetical consent. I also have a transcendentalist argument for consent in which I argue basically you cannot escape the morally binding power of consent because the very act of arguing with someone shows that you care about consent. It's along the lines of Kant's metaphysical transcendental argument, but it's a transcendental argument applied to different contexts. Now, to go to your first question, I guess I'd say about that, so that you may say there's a provision of the Constitution, I understand it, and I don't like it. I don't think Congress should be allowed to issue letters of mark and reprisal. Well, I'd say that raises a problem, but I guess I haven't got to that yet. I'll say this, again, looking at contract law, that we at first at least have to figure out what is this supposed agreement that we're going to bind someone to. The problem I'm really focused on is forcing on people terms that they have not agreed to, that they have not consented to in any wise, because my model is sort of an immigrant who speaks good English comes to the United States and wonders what he or she is getting into and gets a pocket constitution and sits down and reads it and says something like, oh, good, they can't take private property but for public use. I can sign on to this. And then
What's that?
Doesn't say that.
And then we spring on them. I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, okay.
I got a copy here. I didn't think you wanted me to sit down and read it. I have to find that thing. The point is, to spring on them the notion that... What's that? Yeah, without just compensation. Okay.
Sorry to have interrupted.
You immigrants, geez. This is why I'm looking out for you, believe me or not. So anyhow, it's the problem really I'm focused on is springing on them meanings that either we say, oh, this came out of a case which you didn't read. It's very complicated. You have to hire a constitutional professor to get this figured out, problem one. Or two, oh, well, that's what it used to mean. Go line up for your public flogging, because back in the day, that was okay. In neither case do I think it's fair to say to that immigrant, or indeed anyone who's subjected to this constitutional text, you consented to that because you're here, or because you read it and said it was a good idea, or even hypothetically, because you're springing on them a meaning that they really don't have any reason to be bound to. We'd never allow that in contract law. I don't think we should allow it in constitutional law. I better stop there.
We have time for one more question, and then afterwards the next panel, but I'm sure that during the reception there'll be plenty of time to discuss these issues with the authors. Yes. Tim? The floor has been yielded to you.
This is another question for Professor Bell. I'm actually really worried about
that. Is there any other question for anybody other than for Don? All right.
Thank you. This is a question for Minor. The question is, in corporate law, ratification by the shareholders often has a legal consequence. Do you see, would say on pay have that same legal consequence if it gets the yes vote, and what would it be in this circumstance?
No, it doesn't have any legal consequence. First, it's not. It's merely an up or down vote on whatever's disclosed in the corporation's proxy. So it's not clear exactly if there were a legal challenge about the validity of some contract between the CEO and the corporation, what effect you could even say that the ratification has. I think the idea is that it's just more supposed to be a way for shareholders to sort of voice their concerns more than anything else. I don't really think it certainly doesn't, and I can't even imagine how it would have any kind of legal significance.
With this, we close the panel, and thank you very much for all the panelists.